Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It's February 2008. Do you know how safe your money is? The dollar is down, oil prices are up, interest rates are down, loan defaults are up, and an estimated 1 in 10 U.S. homeowners is upside down in his or her mortgage. So is a recession inevitable or perhaps already underway? Where will the economy go next? And what does any of it really mean for you and me? My guest today is not only good at turning reams of market data and arcane financial terminology into plain English, he actually enjoys the process. Alan Sloan is senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, and he contributes regular commentaries to public radio's Marketplace program. Last night, he delivered the William O'Neill Lecture in Business Journalism at SMU, and we are delighted that he was able to stay in town long enough to be here with us today. Alan, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here, Chris.
So this morning, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke gave the sign that he is open to further interest rate cuts. What does that tell you about his assessment of the economic outlook?
I mean, I can only guess, but I guess he's worried about the economic outlook, or more likely, he's worried about the financial system in the United States and the world, because I think it's worries about the possible seizing up of the financial system that's behind a lot of this, and it has little or nothing to do with economics, but a lot to do with all sorts of systemic problems that have been created by securities that nobody understands, and many of which I can't even pronounce.
So the markets are always delighted to hear news like this, but I wonder, when it actually happens, will they not react?
Well, if I could be, even though I'm from out of town, somewhat didactic, the stock market may like this, but there are markets in the world far more important than the stock market, like the bond market and other financial markets. And as I hate to say, I predicted back in the summer, when the United States starts cutting short-term interest rates, which is all the Fed has control over, all sorts of nasty things start to happen. I think one of the reasons the dollar is weak is the cut in these rates. I think one of the reasons oil prices and many of these things are rising is because of the cut in the short-term rates. So the fact that the stock market likes short-term rates cut doesn't mean that it's good for all of us if the Fed cuts them. I'm just sort of difficult on this subject. That's what happens when you're a recovering English major and have never been introduced to the delights of sophisticated economics from PhDs.
Well, you've characterized the Fed at some points as being somewhat like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, not as powerful as anybody thinks it is.
Well, that's true. And they would tell you the same. The governors, they wouldn't come on the show and tell you that. But their ability to influence events is much less than it used to be. I mean, The Wizard of Oz was a complete fraud, and I just do that to be sometimes a little bit outrageous and funny. But they are not in control of events. Much of what's happening in the financial markets, there are all sorts of freeze-ups and things that you keep hearing about, and markets no one even realized existed outside of the professionals suddenly show up on our doorstep with their legs in the air begging for mercy. They've been unable to fix this. They're trying. They're doing the best they can because their primary job is to protect the financial system. But it's getting harder and harder for them to do because the Fed is less and less important relative to the rest of the world, and markets are more and more important. And it's very hard to be Ben Bernanke because I hope he's doing this for something other than the money, because this is a really hard job. He didn't get paid that much.
Does Bernanke have it harder than Alan Greenspan had it? Alan Greenspan was viewed to be this sort of almost omnipotent figure.
He was viewed as both omnipotent and omniscient, but not by me. And actually not by him on those rare occasions when he and I would talk. Bernanke's problem is that the Fed's ability to influence things is much less than it was. Also, and this sounds very strange coming from someone who's a journalist, I'm supposed to want transparency. I think Greenspan did a better job of keeping the markets off balance, which amplified – by the markets, I mean not only the stock market, but the financial markets as a whole off balance, which amplified the Fed's power. And Bernanke, being a very decent guy, and B, being an academic, believes in transparency, which means telling people what you're doing, which to me means it just gives the various people on Wall Street the ability to front run him without fear. And I mean, I guess that's what he believes in, and maybe that's what he should do. but I find myself more Greenspan-esque, even though Bernanke speaks much clearer English than Greenspan ever did.
So you spoke earlier about the fact that there are far more important markets to look at than just the stock market. Can you talk about what indicators you go to first to sort of read the tea leaves as to where we are and where we're going?
Well, I again, some of this gets technical, and I don't want to bore everybody, but I worry about things like long-term interest rates. I'm looking at the short-term interest rates, many of which are below the floor set by the Fed. And the reason they're below the floor set by the Fed, like I think the two-year bond, the two-year treasury bonds, I think 2% now. And the Fed is saying that overnight money, which is much short-term money, is the target is 3%, which means something very strange is happening because all things being equal, a longer-term security should have a higher interest rate than a shorter-term security because your money is tied up and you're at risk. So there are all sorts of dislocations in the market and the what they call the yield curve, which, again, I wouldn't even try to explain, but it's basically the farther out you go, the longer the maturity, the higher the interest rate is supposed to be. And that's sort of not how it is. There are very strange things going on, and there are entire markets, many of which I don't understand, for certain kinds of loans and certain kinds of mortgages, where it's very, very hard to get anything done because people are afraid to lend and big institutions aren't really sure what's going on in their own balance sheets because you see every day some organization says, oh, gee, we have to take another $2 billion loss. So you say to yourself, if you're an institution, gee, we've been trying for a year to get a hand on what's going on in our own institution. We're not really sure we know how we know what's going on over there with these other guys, and why would we want to lend to them? And the other thing is the Fed, for reasons known only to the Fed, had made what's called coming to the window, borrowing directly from the Fed, which used to be the way it bailed out people who had problems. That became, for reasons I'm not sure about, shameful. And it was a bad thing to do. So the Fed had to set up an entire new facility that it calls the temporary auction facility to do the thing it used to do with the discount window, only it can't do it with the discount window because nobody wants to use it. It's a sign the world has really gotten out of hand.
And nobody wants to use it because there's a perception that they must be in dire straits. Is that the problem?
Right. And when I asked, well, if people think it's dire straits to be at the discount window, why would they use the temporary auction facility? Because wouldn't any rational person conclude that if you're using the temporary auction facility, you'd otherwise be at the discount window? So what's the difference?
the line just moved over.
See, this is what happens when you're an English major and you think this way. And the answer, all very unofficial, and was, well, two things. One is we're not going to tell anybody who's borrowing at the temporary auction facility. And B, we hope to make the interest rate so low that we'll bribe them into doing it because it'll be so cheap they can't resist.
So President Bush's economic stimulus package is supposed to send millions of checks out sometime in May to people. What do you think will happen with that money?
I think people will spend it. And again, I'm just being finicky. Because I don't think this is such a great idea, and in the past I've been somewhat less than complimentary to President Bush's policies. I mean, it's not as if President Bush invented this policy. It's him and the Democrats in this together. It's not his. It's theirs. And maybe it'll work, but it's not clear to me how borrowing what is the number now, Chris? $185 billion? From, I don't know, the Chinese government or whoever it is who's going to lend us the money, how borrowing all that money to send to people to spend to stimulate the economy, it's not clear to me how that'll work. But if some people think it'll work, I mean, it's fine with me. I'm luckily so high income, I don't get any of this money. So in any event, I wouldn't spend it anyway, but I may just go out and buy something just to be helpful.
How dependent is the safety of the U.S. economy on foreign investment right now?
Well, it's enormous. This is, again, a recurring theme of mine that I was beating the drums on back when nobody cared. And I believe that something more than half of the federal deficit is now owned of the federal – let me rephrase that – that foreigners are funding essentially all of the cash federal budget deficit – since President Bush took office. I mean, not because, you know, it was President Bush, but because of the policies. And one of these days, and the day may be coming, and I've been saying this for years, people are going to say, wait a minute. We're getting these dollars, which are dropping relative to our home currency. We're not really getting much of an interest rate. What do we need this for? And I suspect that that's one of the reasons we suddenly see sovereign wealth funds from countries like China and Russia, which used to do nothing but buy treasury securities. And now they're saying, well, these are sovereign wealth funds, and that gives them a reason to not own treasury securities and to own other things other than treasuries without drawing the wrath of the U.S. Treasury Department or the president. I think that's partly a reaction to what's going on with the dollar.
And where are Americans putting the bulk of their foreign investments?
Well, Americans are buying, including, I have to say, me, which breaks my heart because I really am – I love the United States. I'm an economic patriot. But about 3 or 4 years ago, I finally said, well, this is crazy. I can't keep buying U.S. stocks and having them decline in value relative to the rest of the world and relative to the dollar. You know, I just don't want to do this anymore. And I now have something like a third of my stock investments – in non-U.S. securities, I mean all through funds. And that's what a lot of people are doing, and that's been one of the fastest growing areas in the mutual fund biz has been funds investing in non-U.S. stocks. And you know, I find that sad because, again, I love this country. I'd like to invest in this country. But in the end, the only people who are available to pay for my wife's retirement and mine is us. And, you know, I just can't keep doing things that are not in my financial interest.
You are scrupulous to a fault about always disclosing when you have an interest in something that you happen to be writing about. Did it take a while for you to be really comfortable with that?
I've always been comfortable with it. I was uncomfortable not doing it longer ago than I – one of the reasons I wanted to write a column, which dates back years, and I've not been writing a column for, almost 20 years – is I wanted to be able to just disclose this instead of meeting some sort of complicated rules that my owner or publisher or editors had. My idea was I'm talking directly to readers, which if you read my stuff is what I try to do. I try to write this as if I were sitting in a bar or to be nice, in a coffee house talking to the people reading my column. Except I leave out the run-on sentences and the obscenities, you know, just like I'm being polite here.
It's like the radio, exactly.
It's like, you know, and I figure if there's something that I think the other person involved in this would like to know, I want to tell her, and I just tell her. And it's generally my decision, and I just do it because I want people – if I thought these things influenced me, I wouldn't be writing about these topics. But the readers or the audience has a right to know that I have an interest in the outcome, and I just tell them and the audience can judge for itself.
But you do know, of course, that what you write influences other people, and that's a burden, is it not?
Well, it's not a burden. It's one of the things I exist to do. I mean, I don't get up every morning and say the weight of the weight is on my shoulders. Oh, my God. Well, I'm worthy of this burden. This is my job, is to write or, in this case, talk about these things. And I just do it because it's my job. And I don't do this with an eye to influencing events. I do it with an eye to telling people what I think they ought to know. And what they do with that is their business. But there are some times where it's so clear I make recommendations, but I don't often do that. I'm a big believer in the market. Here's the information. Do what you want with it. And by the way, I'm a party in interest to some extent, and you should know that when analyzing what I say.
Alan Sloan is my guest. He's senior editor-at-large of Fortune magazine. He's also a commentator on Marketplace. We'll resume our conversation after this quick break, and you can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, also a marketplace commentator, Alan Sloan. He's in town because last night he delivered the William O'Neill Lecture in Business Journalism at SMU. If you'd like to join our conversation today, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So in addition to always disclosing whatever interest you have, one thing that I think really distinguishes your work, Alan, is that you make a point of reminding people that some of the things you write about and talk about can't be known definitively, as opposed to so many other people who write about the markets and about business and about economic conditions as though they have looked at every piece of data and can say definitively what the truth is.
Well, maybe that's because I'm very secure or a very bad reporter. It's just the world is full of uncertainty. And because I've been fortunate enough to be in a position where I can write a column in my own voice, I tell people what I really think and what I really believe the case to be, because I'm not going to try to tell people things are definitive if I don't think they are. That's not my business. If you and I were sitting having a conversation, I wouldn't treat you that way, and the audience is an extension of you. It's the way I like to be treated when I talk to people, and I figure they like to be treated that way when I talk to them, which I do either with my voice or my fingers by typing.
Are the markets worse off in some ways now that there are so many sort of regular people who don't have the time to spend hours every week sort of researching everything? So many people who are involved and maybe making decisions based on one headline that they heard.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to get your head handed to you. If you think you're listening to the radio or watching television and someone gives you this idea and you say, wow, what a great idea. Well, very likely the person who's giving you this idea has acted on it, which in some places they'll tell you. A lot of people may have acted on it. And just because somebody says something is good doesn't mean it is, because she may have bought it 10 points ago. And, you know, she's talking about it now, and for all you know, if you run it up, she may sell it to you and buy it back cheap again. It's not a way to invest. If you're not going to pay attention, and who pays attention? I don't pay all that much attention. That's why the world invented mutual funds and things like that. I mean, that's what they're for, because it's better to pay a relatively low fee to a professional to watch your money than to do it in some sort of backhanded way, because that way you really get your head handed to you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. We're always told that the consumer represents 70% of the economy. But, you know, you can only buy so much food, so many clothes, you know, one car every 4 years, whatever. And to me, that the economy is always going to get sluggish unless we have transformative business innovations and inventions. Like, you know, Google was transformative. The PC was transformative. The car from the buggy was transformative. But if we're just, you know, being told, well, we just need to go out to eat more and buy more clothes, buy more shoes, I don't see this kind of treadmill we're on coming to an end. And I'd like to know, Alan, if you agree that we're not going to get out of this economic malaise until we have more transformative economic development.
Yeah, well, it depends. I generally agree with you. And the idea that we can spend ourselves to prosperity, well, that's what's been going on for the last 8 or 10 years. And if you look at what's happened with houses and the amount of money that people took out of their houses by refinancing them and stuff, that borrowing drove a lot of the economy. And when house prices are dropping and so many people owe 100% of the value of their house on the mortgage, they can't take any more money out, because in this market, even the dumbest lenders aren't dumb enough to lend to someone who's what they call upside down in the house. So the transformative event you're talking about was the ability of millions of people to treat their houses like ATMs, which is not productive, I mean, which is your point. So the money got borrowed, the money got spent, and now it needs to be repaid, and something has to happen to make people able to repay it, and sooner or later it'll work itself out. But I would not want to be somebody heavily in debt with a mortgage of 110% of my equity, not able to cover my loans and credit card payments. It's an ugly scene out there.
So I'm going to ask for your opinion on this. Certainly, we know that there were a lot of irresponsible lenders who looked at people and probably should have been able to tell that there would be problems down the line. But I have to wonder about the individuals who should have been able to look at their own budgets and say, this isn't going to work out if the interest rates change. Who deserves to get bailed out, if anybody, in these cases?
Well, this is one of these cases where I drive my editors insane because I say things like case to case. It's a case to case thing. You have to look at one and look at the other. In some cases, people were misled. In other cases, people got in over their heads or were speculating. In October, I wrote a long piece in Fortune dissecting one particular issue of mortgage-backed securities that Goldman Sachs had sold to people, which was just a disaster. And if you read the documents, which I did, you started to laugh because here were people borrowing 100% or actually on an average 99.4% of the house price, and 98% of them said it was their primary residence. But you didn't have to document this. And you look at this and you know that most of those people aren't telling the truth. And a tremendous number of those loans have defaulted because the minute the people couldn't make the payments, they walked from the house because they weren't really living there. They were trying to flip it or rent it out. And they walked. And that was so obvious from the start. You wonder how people did it. But this is Goldman Sachs, which is not a stupid operation. And they sold the stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Ramus in Duncanville. Hi, Ramus.
Yes. I think we need more people in Washington running this country like your guest, who was going to speak the truth and see things the way they are. You know, I've been in this country only for 10 years, and I realized back then when I first stepped foot in here that there's something wrong with this economy. Everybody was trying to sell me something. Look, we can't have 72% of our economy based on retail. I mean, it's not going to work. And in addition to that, they take the jobs to China. If I don't have a paycheck, I'm not going to buy stuff. I mean, it's like this country is run by a bunch of morons. It's going to fail. It was meant to fail a long time ago.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not as extreme as our caller, but in general, I agree with him. Yeah, I mean, this isn't going to work. And I, being old and a scaredy cat, I have been very careful to reduce my debt, make sure that I live within my means. And the advice I give everybody, including many people don't want to hear it, is the only way you will succeed financially is to live within your means. And if you can't afford to make that house payment and have no reason to think you'll be able to make it, well, maybe you shouldn't buy the house. But that's not what you're supposed to. You know, people believe in instant gratification. I'm not an instant gratification kind of guy. I'm 63 years old and, I'm sort of beat up. I don't believe in instant gratification.
So we opened the paper yesterday. The New York Times is talking about $4 a gallon gasoline by the summer. First of all, what do you think changes if that actually happens here?
Well, nothing good. And the other thing you say to yourself is you say, self, gee, maybe back when oil was $1 or $1.50 and it was starting to, oil prices were starting to get out of hand, maybe we really should have put $1 or a $2 tax on oil, paid the money to ourselves in some way, and if you like, figure out some way to get that money back to people who can't really afford it. But that way, if we're going to have a lot higher oil prices and use less oil, at least we're paying it to ourselves instead of sending the money overseas, which is what we're doing now. But heaven help you if you propose anything like that. I mean, I can propose it because I'm not running for elective office, and I haven't proposed it just because I don't want to overload Fortune's email system with outraged mail of how can you do this? You're a communist. You're evil. But in fact, we should have done that long ago. Maybe we should do it now because right now there's a tremendous financial momentum in the price of oil, and a lot of it is trading as opposed to economics. And who knows what's going to happen? If gas goes to $4 a gallon, we'll be the same as Europe. The difference is in Europe, it's in taxes, and they drive small cars. And here we'll be driving big cars and sending the money overseas.
Well, that's an interesting point because clearly lifestyles are different between the United States and Europe. But you see very few comparisons when we talk about all the people that are going to be destroyed by paying 25% more than they're paying now. And it is a burden for people. But I wonder why we don't look to other parts of the world where gasoline is already that expensive. offensive and recognize that they've found ways to cope with it.
Because, again, this is – and especially here in Texas, and in case you can't tell from my voice, I'm really not from here. I take
you don't have that twang.
I don't. I've been working on it, but I don't think I'm going to – maybe I'll buy a hat and try to pass, but I don't think that will work. But – I come from a part of the world where there's mass transit, though my children, some of whom live in my part of the world, you know, they live in cars. I look up a train schedule. You know, my children drive, but my children drive smallish cars. We've gotten used to doing what we're doing because it works. Anytime anybody proposes to really raise the gas tax or do anything like that, they're hounded out of office and attacked. A rational economic policy would do this, but as one of our previous callers pointed out, rational and economics and policy are not words often combined in Washington, and nobody wants to risk the wrath of the voter by saying this. And I don't care because, as I said, I'm 63. I'm not running for office.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Alan Sloan. He is senior editor-at-large of Fortune magazine, and you've probably heard his commentaries on Marketplace on this station. Let's go next to Beth in Fort Worth. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I was just curious what your guest would imagine the repercussions to be if we were to become patriotic by saving and paying down debt instead of spending. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Beth, you must have been either reading my stuff or reading my mind. I actually proposed years ago that we pay for Iraq, since people like me are not fighting in Iraq because I'm too old. I thought maybe it would be nice to pay for it by paying more income taxes so that the people fighting the war, when they come back here, don't get stuck with the interest bill on the money we borrowed to fight it. You know, and I thought this was a total lay down and so obvious I didn't even have to say it, because I thought that was patriotic, which means sacrificing something for a country you love. That's my definition of patriotism. And, oh, you should have seen it. Oh, you're a commie, you're a this, you're a that, you're some evil Democrat, as if Democrat. I mean, it's just craziness, because sooner or later, to make all the stuff going on in this country work, someone's going to have to give up something. And I suspect it's going to be the people like me who are old are going to give up some of our Social Security and some of our Medicare. Because if you look at some of these numbers, in the future, it does not work. It does not work. And we'd be better off facing it now, but no one wants to face it now. Nobody wants to deal with the idea of having an oil tax. I've proposed, though everyone laughs at me, a sovereign wealth fund for Social Security, where we invest the surplus in something other than U.S. treasuries. So when Social Security starts running low on cash, we have something to pay for it with. And people treat me like I'm a complete lunatic. And maybe I am, but not for this.
Would it be reasonable at some point to decide that people only qualified for Social Security if they were – if they had earned, say, under a certain amount in their lifetime?
Yeah. This is, again, another one of the things that I've had endlessly. I would actually do it differently, because people like me have paid tons of money into Social Security. As far as I'm concerned, you know, cut my benefits some, tax a lot of it away. But to say, well, Alan, you know, you paid for 40 years, but now because you've been prudent enough to save –
you get nothing.
You get nothing. I mean, that then turns Social Security into a total welfare program as opposed to an earned benefit, which it sort of is now. So, I mean, I would tax it. I would slow down the growth in the benefits to people like me. But to say, well, suddenly you're getting nothing, I mean, I just don't think that's right. And again, to me personally, it probably would not make any difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Ron in Dallas. Hey, Ron.
Hi. Alan, first of all, welcome to town. And second of all, I think you should buy that hat. It would look good on you. And regards to the family.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to know your opinion as to what impact hype has on keeping the market and the economy artificially inflated and artificially down. For example, you know, a few years ago, I mean, you couldn't turn on the TV without seeing 5 brokerage ads within the next 5 minutes. I think that probably kept prices artificially high because, you know, people kept investing because everybody on TV was telling them to do so. Now that things are going down the drain, It's my opinion that it's going to stay low, at least the market's going to stay low longer, because the perception is things are terrible. Even if things tend to perk up a little bit, I think it's going to take a long while for the market to recover because of just the hype and everybody focusing on it will keep it depressed for a longer period of time than it deserves to be. So I think it was artificially high when it shouldn't have been, and it's going to stay artificially low when it shouldn't be either. I'd like to know your opinion on that.
Well, again, you're also someone who sounds like, you know, he's read either my mind or what I've written, because what I write all the time is things have a tendency to go from being higher than they should be economically to lower than they should be economically. The trick, which I've never been able to solve, is to be able to figure out which is which and when to get on and off the train. I don't think stocks as a whole are depressed. I mean, the NASDAQ is still way below where it was. But the Dow and the Standard & Poor's and the Wilshire, the very big broad indexes, they're not all that far below their all-time highs. They're not depressed. But, I mean, enthusiasm runs it up. Enthusiasm runs it down. I was sitting during the Super Bowl, which amazingly my team won, you know, which made it a good day, looking at these brokerage ads where they're showing you how easy it is to buy stocks. Well, it's easy to buy stocks, but it's hard to make money.
It's hard to pick stocks.
Right, to pick stocks. They forgot to mention that. I mean, any idiot can push a button and buy something if he has an account. The idea is figuring out what to buy and then when to sell it. But I guess maybe that comes in the next commercial.
I want to, and we'll have to talk more about this after the break, but I want to talk about your definition of the word recession, because it's a little bit different than the sort of standard.
Okay. I am, of course, a coward when it comes to things like this. And my definition of a recession is a recession when a recession has been declared by the, I love this term, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. I just love the concept of business cycle dating. It makes me think of, you know, an online social club. and well after the fact, they say, okay, there was a recession. And by the time they announce it, as the chairman of the committee told me, it may well be over. But I mean, that's the definition of a recession to me. Other people define it as 6 months of gross domestic product growing slower than inflation, or to use the term, 6 months of decline, six straight months of decline of real GDP. You know, take your choice. I go with the committee because I'd rather have people than a formula.
After the break, we'll talk about the impact of that declaration of recession with Alan Sloan. He's senior editor at large of Fortune magazine and a regular commentator on Marketplace. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Alan Sloan, the senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine and a regular Marketplace commentator. He was in town to deliver last night's William O'Neill Lecture in Business Journalism at SMU. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. So now that we know that your definition of recession, or the one that you like the best, doesn't even apply until it might actually be over, I wonder if you can talk about the psychological impact of this. Because people, regular people making decisions, not in the markets, not in big ways, hear that word and start to really, really worry.
Right. You see, I think that worrying about whether we're in a recession is basically useless. It fills a lot of airtime, fills a lot of space. It's basically useless because you generally don't find out you're in a recession until it's at the bottom, close to the bottom, or ended. So, you know, what does it matter if you call it a recession or not? What do you accomplish? What is the purpose? Especially when, as you've said, there are different definitions of what a recession is. I don't see the point of it, but it makes people happy. It gives them something to discuss, something to worry about. And what is our profession without something to worry about and chew over? But I wrote a column saying, why are we bothering with this? And I quoted the head of the Business Cycle Dating Committee, who's a very good guy from Stanford, is saying by the time we declare that a recession has started, no one's interested in talking to me anymore.
So is there any way to prepare for something like this, to make sure that when it does come, if we're unaware of it at the time, that we are in a good position to weather it?
Well, you have to – again, this is just me. I'm very conservative financially. You have to be in a position to take care of yourself. Whether there is or isn't a recession doesn't matter to you. I mean, what matters to you is your personal situation. And your personal situation might or might not be affected by a recession, but you need to be in a position where you can take care of yourself, you're able to pay your bills, you don't owe too much money, and you can function. If that way you can go about your business without worrying about whether there's a recession, because there's nothing you can do about it anyway, and all you're doing is distracting yourself. Now I say things like this at story meetings. You know, people look at me, they start to send out for the straitjackets. They say, Alan's at it again. You know, he's doing it again. Will someone please change the topic? So, and you know, that's what happens.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go up to Denton next and talk to Bob. Hey, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions. I remember the savings and loan debacle of the late 80s. And obviously we're having a similar problem now involving the government's encouraging business, the loan industry, to make loans to people who, on signature, who no way they could pay the note. I know when I first bought my first house that, you know, they looked all over my finances to make sure I could just make the monthly note. But what I'm looking at here, the question is, is there anything to be done about the predatory lending practices of the credit card companies? I know my kids are in college, and there isn't a day in the week where one or both of them doesn't get some free, you know, credit card application, and this is just going to, again, hurt the weakest and the poorest.
Well, Bob, let's get an answer, and I'll have to just take one call because we've got a whole board of people that want to ask questions, but I do appreciate it. One question from you. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah. All right. I hate that. I hate those solicitations. I see them all the time. I hate them. If I ran the zoo, I would make it really punitive for them to do this, because preying on the weak is not appropriate, and they specifically target people who've just come out of bankruptcy. I would really penalize them for that, but I don't run the show.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Shahet in Allen. Hi, Shahet.
Hi. My name is Shahet, and hi to both of you.
Hi.
My question is a very simple one. That in the last 3 to 4 years, the oil prices have nearly doubled. But the world oil demand hasn't doubled. And my simple knowledge of economics tells me that pricing is structured with supply and demand. So who's eating away the money? The oil companies or the producers or what?
My guess, again, is a question I've asked myself. I think a lot of it, there's a tremendous amount of financial speculation that goes around oil and around many of these energy sources, and it has a tendency to run stuff way, way higher than economics would indicate. And then when it breaks, it goes way, way low. It's not pure supply and demand. The swings are being made more extreme by financial speculation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jeff in Dallas. Hey, Jeff.
Yes. Hello, Alan.
Hi.
What are your thoughts on oil being traded in other currencies other than the U.S. dollar? And does high oil prices help the dollar?
I'm not sure. I think oil has traditionally traded in dollars. I'm not sure why, but it has. And that if someday the oil producers catch on and start getting a basket of currencies, prices may go higher. And in fact, for all I know, part of what's driving oil prices up might be the unwillingness of producers to have dollars, you know, that and combined with the speculation I just talked about. I just don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm amazed that it's gone on this long where things like euros or a basket of currency have not become the means in which oil producers get paid.
Are people just unwilling to switch from what they've done all along? Do you think that's part of it?
I just don't know. Don't know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email from Mike who asks, I'd like to know if Mr. Sloan has any opinions on commentators who preach the efficiency of the marketplace, i.e. the market works. I can buy that Walmart shirt for cheaper than 10 years ago as a panacea to many, if not all, of the economic ills that we see.
That's a very clever question. The answer is, well, it may work for you if you're buying the Walmart shirt, but it won't work so well for you if you're the person who used to make that Walmart shirt in, say, Arkansas, and it's now being made in – I don't know where these shirts were made, or now it's being made in China. I mean, generally speaking, I think the people all in favor of, you know, the market working out are people like me who don't have to worry about it because no one's outsourcing my job to China.
Then again, if you lose your job, there aren't a whole lot of others to go around that are just like it.
That's true, but I'm a big boy and I'm prepared. I always live as if the world is – no, I'm kidding. I don't know that the world will end, but you know, I generally have what I learned in journalism. They called it a go-to-hell fund, which is probably a word I shouldn't have used here. But it was called I have enough money to survive if I don't get paid for a while and – that's how I do it, and then I worry about the rest of it.
Do you think everybody should live with the economic equivalent of, you know, 16 propane tanks in the basement and you know, enough food for a year? I mean, how much money do you think people ought to have in reserve?
Well, I'm a little extreme because when I do what I do, and at some of the places I've done it, I was really putting my job at risk and really annoying people who could cause me trouble. So I had to be prepared in case something happened, but nothing ever did. Nothing ever did. I never had any real problems, but I had to act as if I could have them, and that may be one of the reasons nothing happened. I mean, of course, you know, you don't want to go live in a bomb shelter. It's a question of what stage of your life you're in, what your debts are, what your family situation is. My wife and I have three children. They're all grown and out of the house and self-supporting. So, you know, my circumstances are different now than they were 20 years ago when I had college ahead of me, you know, and I was feeding two or three colleges at once and three children. I mean, my need for security is less than it was because my expenses are less.
Let's go next to Byron in Dallas. Hey, Byron.
Hi. My question was, how productive is military spending? I mean, what pays off on the long run, a taxi cab or an M16?
This is one of those things that people with fancy degrees and spreadsheets have argued about for years. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to duck the question and say, I don't know.
We have a question about whether the Asian economy, where it's headed, and whether you think China will experience a slowdown after the Olympics.
If I knew that, I'd be so rich. I wouldn't have to work anymore. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. And here's... here's a quote from someone that just wanted to share this. A recession is when you're out of work. A depression is when your wife is out of work. Just thought we would. We don't normally take jokes on the air here, but we thought it would work with you.
Well, we got to have some sense of humor.
Exactly. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Frank in Fort Worth. Hey, Frank.
Yeah, I had a question for Alan. Since the beginning of the 1900s, there was a relationship. The spreadsheets have shown the relationship between war and this country is economic prosperity. I was wondering, why is it that now that we're in a war in Iraq and Afghanistan, why is that not helping the economy presently?
Somewhat along the lines of what we had before.
Yeah,
but
that's not a question I know anything about, so I respectfully take a pass.
Where do you think we're going? You know, if there is a recession on the horizon, or perhaps we've started in one right now, are you able to sort of make predictions? Do you make predictions 18 months out and 3 years out?
No.
Fair enough. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Gary in Plano. Hey, Gary.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, great. I'll be brief. My question is, where have the parents been? I mean, we've got people in for the last 25 years deregulating industries that were regulated, very necessarily so, back in the other end of the century, and it just seems like everybody forgot their history about regulation, about why these big industries need to be regulated. And when George Bush came to office in 2001, he brought with him the ideas from Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist to drown the baby, or I forget the exact quote, but you know what I'm saying.
Throw out the baby with the bathwater. Well, there are pros and cons, a lot of people think, to deregulation of major industries.
Yeah, well, it depends, again, what you've deregulated. And I'm not a great fan of regulation, but, I mean, there are certain things I think you need to regulate. It is a question of deciding what it is. And, again, it's a case-by-case thing. And I don't have a philosophy. I'm sort of a pragmatic guy, so I just sort of take them one at a time, and I don't have any broad opinions because my broad opinion isn't worth anything.
The term stagflation is starting to be tossed around a little bit. What do you think about that?
Well, it fills a lot of space. sounds good. I don't know. I mean, again, what does it accomplish, Chris? I mean, okay, let's say we're in stagflation, you know, which is a combination of stagnation and inflation for, you know, people who don't know. Okay, that's like saying, well, are we in a recession? Are we not in a recession? Well, you know, okay, maybe we are, maybe we're not, but how do we know and what does it matter? You just need to take care of yourself.
And I guess, do you feel the same way about consumer confidence indexes? It's supposed to be at a 5-year low as of this week.
All right, consumer confidence indexes started as a way to sort of predict what the stock market would do. And they were, I guess, a useful tool to that, may still be a useful tool for that, but they've now become a thing in themselves. There are now all of these statistics that used to be viewed as, you know, the producer's price index and all of these things that used to be viewed as part of a big picture where you could put it into a big picture. And now every one of the things people sit and obsess about, and you can go mad doing that. And if I'm going to go mad, I want to get paid for it. I don't get paid to worry about this. So I sit and take the broader view because I just don't have enough wisdom to know what any month's numbers might or might not mean.
Do you have a sense that the elections and whoever is elected in November will have a great deal of immediate sort of emotional impact on the economic status of this country?
It'll have an emotional impact. Again, making myself endlessly unpopular, I'm one of the people who thinks that the world does not revolve around Washington and does not revolve around the Federal Reserve, and that the president, while powerful, is not all-powerful. And there are a lot of things at play. And yeah, the election, however it works out, will be one factor among many, but it's not going to be the factor that decides how the economy will do.
Alan Sloan is senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, and he contributes regular commentaries to Public Radio's Marketplace program. He last night delivered the William O'Neill Lecture in Business Journalism at SMU. Alan, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.